Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 through 17. Jesus draws on, or Matthew, I should say, draws on a prophecy by the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 2. And he's using it to define Jesus' purpose. And his purpose is to bring light where darkness once resided. Think about the dawn. Think about light bursting forth on the new day. I don't know how many of you are up at dawn, but it's a glorious time, actually, if you can get yourself out of bed. Some of us have a little trouble rousing ourselves that early, but the fact is it is a rather glorious time to be alive and to just look at how things just brighten up. That's what Jesus does for our spiritual lives. And as Jesus proceeded through his ministry, he began to point out, number one, the darkness of humanity's deeds in John chapter 3, verse 19. He says that people love the darkness rather than the light. They were afraid of the light. They scattered, perhaps, when the light came into the world. And he calls himself in John 8, 12, the light of the world. He came to bring light where darkness covered the minds of men. You know, it's probably a bit of a shock for people who have grown accustomed to the darkness to have to deal with light. You know, your eyes get accustomed to it. Your souls grow accustomed to it. Whether you realize it or not, it's in those patterns where you have kind of grown accustomed to the darkness where Jesus comes and he sort of cuts and he shines a light on them. And maybe we get a little bit nervous when we realize that our souls have this darkness within them. Difficult sometimes for us to admit that. But that's Jesus' purpose, to pierce that darkness. Let's go back into the Old Testament a little bit, because I want you to see how this whole concept kind of begins to play out. It plays out early on by the prophetic message of people like Isaiah, who told the Israelites that was going to be a part of what the Messiah was going to do. He was going to bring light where there was darkness. In Isaiah chapter 29, the prophet predicts that blindness will be something that has overcome the people of Israel. In fact, it's in this passage, interestingly enough, in Isaiah chapter 29, verses 9 through 14, that we find that he makes the prediction here how that people who have been honoring him with their lips, but their hearts are really far from him. Okay? And he talks about that in terms of it's a kind of blindness that has happened. You know, I've kind of realized a number of years ago that I always knew it, but, you know, we think people who can't, let me back up and say it a better way. Do not think that people who don't accept the gospel are not very smart. That's not the problem. It's not a matter of being smart or not, or unintelligent or not. It's a matter of blindness. That's the way the New Testament and the Old Testament describes it, and it's different. And maybe it takes a different approach when we think about that. But the prophet in Isaiah chapter 29 is telling us that blindness is going to overcome people. He allows that God will change their blindness in verses 18 and 19 of this same passages. In a day when God brings about judgment and righteousness. In Isaiah chapter 35, verses 5 and 6, in the spirit of redemption, he says that God is going to offer redemption and freedom from blindness. And of course, we know when Jesus began his work in Luke chapter 4 and verse 18, he says, "The Spirit of the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to bring sight to the blind," which is basically a quote from Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 and 2. So, of all the prophets, certainly Isaiah kind of gave us that idea more than others. He planted that seed for Israel to be aware of, you know what, guys? The Messiah is going to bring light and sight to the blind. Now, they obviously, I think at times, didn't realize they were in that category themselves. They thought it was meant for everybody else. But I'd like us to ask the question here, what would those things, what would these prophecies mean for a later generation? How would they affect a later generation? In Luke 4, at least, when Jesus reads these words from the prophet Isaiah, you know how they react to them? They said, wow, they really liked his gracious words. It sounded very gracious of what God was going to do, is going to bring freedom for the captives and sight to the blind. But if you go and you look at that passage, and after a little further discussion, Jesus makes it very clear that, hey guys, I'm talking about you as well. And they really don't particularly care for that. But when John the Baptist wondered whether or not Jesus really was the Christ, you remember a little incident where he sends some of his own disciples to talk to Jesus. And this is in both Matthew 11, verses 4 and 6, and in Luke chapter 7. John seems a little uncertain. John's in prison by this time. You have to remember that. And all he's hearing probably is the rumors about Jesus. Jesus did this, Jesus did that. Jesus was this, Jesus wasn't that, blah, blah, blah. There's all kinds of things floating around. John's not necessarily getting the right scoop here. And so he sends disciples to Jesus and said, are you really the one that we're waiting for? And what does Jesus answer? Jesus answers by saying, he makes these allusions to Isaiah's prophecy. The blind are healed, the lame walk, and a few other things he mentioned. But most importantly for our discussion today, the blind receive their sight. So Jesus makes allusions to all of Isaiah's prophecies, and he says, that's the message that you give to John. And John hopefully would go, oh, okay, then he is the one we're talking about, okay? Jesus is basically saying, you know what the prophets say about this? Well, they're happening now. They're happening in my ministry. Sight for the blind was part of the messianic mission. When we come into the New Testament, we have this incident with Bartimaeus in Mark chapter 10, verses 46 through 52. And it's kind of an interesting one because here we have this a fulfillment of literally the fulfillment that the blind are going to be able to see. Now, we know as we get on through here, it's going to get a little deeper than that. There's a little more meaning to it. But let's start with this one because this is kind of an interesting one. Jesus is on the way to Jerusalem at this point. His life is nearing the end, and he knows it. His disciples may not know it. It says he was leaving Jericho at the time. And as he's leaving Jericho with a large crowd, and kind of think about what's going on here. Jesus is walking along the road, and there's a fairly good-sized crowd with him. And I think you know what the noises of the crowd might sound like, okay? As a lot of group of people are passing by, perhaps you hear a lot of murmuring, you know, maybe loud talking. But he hears this. Maybe he hears the footsteps. I don't know. You know, blind people have this incredible awareness of sound. They overcompensate because they can't see. So he hears them. He hears this crowd going by. And he's probably been there regularly. In fact, it's interesting because Matthew describes two men, whereas Luke says the blind man was a beggar. So no doubt he sat there regularly. Okay. But he cries out, he hears Jesus passing by. Apparently Jesus' reputation is known to him. He's still got ears. He hears all the rumors. He knows what's going on. Jesus has probably been near that way before. People have talked about him. He's gotten wind of it. So although the crowd tries to suppress him, and you know, again, get the picture here. There's a crowd walking by, and all of a sudden you hear this one voice, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Several times. They tell him to be quiet. He won't. He's desperate. Apparently he believes Jesus can do something for him. He's heard the reports. You know, people in that situation, you may say, well, they want to believe just anything. But it's like, at some point, so what? He believed that Jesus could heal him because he'd heard that people had been healed. And so when Jesus hears him throughout over the crowd, he must have been pretty loud, or at least pretty close, Jesus says, well, just bring him over. And so the crowd sort of mildly rebuked, I guess, for telling the guy to shut up. Jesus says, yeah, come on, yeah, let him come over. He's not going to bother anything. So he comes over, and of course, he cures his blindness. He gets in the crowd and walks to Jerusalem with him. In his case, sight for the blind became a literal reality. But I believe it does point to a deeper form of healing. You know, like a lot of the miracles do, they point to something deeper. You know, Jesus forgave the paralytic before he even healed him of his paralysis because he knew the deeper need of what people have, and that's healing for spiritual blindness. But again, I want to ask the question, what would be the effect on the people in that day? Now, this is kind of an interesting account that Mark gives for several reasons. One I already mentioned. When Matthew tells this story, he says there were two men. When Luke tells the story, he calls one of them a beggar. It still may have been two. We don't really know. Mark names him. Why does Mark give him a name? Think about that. Mark says, yeah, it's Bartimaeus. It's quite possible. And again, a little bit of a supposition here, but it kind of makes sense. People in the early church, when Mark was writing this, they most likely knew Bartimaeus. So I'm going to make the assumption here that he was still around after the church had been established. Let's just assume for the moment that it could have been. What kind of personal influence among the rest of the church could he have had? Think about that. You know, somebody's perhaps dealing with a little bit of doubt about Jesus. You know, let me go get you talk to this guy named Bartimaeus. Tell you what happened to him. What a witness he had to what Jesus did for him. What would a conversation with him sound like? What would he have said? Did he perhaps, you know, let's take this a little further. Might he have been put in charge of the education of the next generation of young people who might be entertaining doubts or struggling with faith or wanting to know about the faith? Okay, guess who your teacher is this week? It's Bartimaeus. Might have been a pretty good guy to put up there, wouldn't it? Had a pretty good story to tell about Jesus. Okay? How would his story affect others? Well, a couple of things stand out. Obviously, the one about him being healed of his blindness is perhaps really the most important thing. But, you know, the first thing he calls out for is mercy. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Second thing, you know, he followed Jesus after he was cured. Isn't it kind of interesting? What's the first thing he probably saw when he was cured of his blindness? Probably Jesus' face. Yeah, kind of interesting just to think about that. And, you know, here's a guy who had been blind, had been begging, had been sitting by the side of the road probably for years. We don't know that he was born blind, like the man in John chapter 9, but we know he was blind, and what that did, he was basically dependent on everybody's compassion. Maybe now he's working. But his effect on the community would be profound, and I think that's why Mark gives us his name. I think people knew him. He identifies just exactly who he was. Jesus healed his blindness. But then we have in John chapter 9 the challenge, what I call the challenge of the man born blind. And this particular story actually is filled with what is essentially the effect on everybody else. How does his blindness, or I should say, the healing of his blindness, affect everybody around him? So what we see here is Jesus heals a guy. He tells him to go wash in a pool, so Jesus is not even around once he gets his sight, but apparently he knows who he is. And then you have in John chapter 9, verses 8 through 12, everybody's talking to him. They couldn't decide if this was really the same guy. And that's sort of one of the interesting effects. They're looking at him and go, well, he kind of looks like him, but now he can see. We don't kind of get that, you know. He readily admits, yeah, I'm the guy. And they're still going, well, you know, maybe it's not really the guy. They're really not sure because something so unusual has happened here that it doesn't fit with their own sense of reality. His parents are another couple of people who are affected by this. And, you know, they have a problem with it. They admitted it was him, but you see, they're afraid of the Pharisees here. And so all they can say is, well, we know it's him, but, you know, I don't know how he got healed. Go ask him. He's old enough to answer for himself. You know, it's kind of, you know, in a way, his parents are kind of throwing him under the bus. You know, they don't want to have to confront the issue that, yeah, this Jesus guy really can heal people. They don't want to admit that to the Pharisees because they know they're going to get thrown out of the synagogue otherwise. So, yeah, they admit it's him. They go and talk to him. And then we have, of course, the scribes and the Pharisees. And they're, I think, the most interesting story because they reflect so much blindness. They are divided, but persistently doubtful of his testimony. In verses 13 through 19, we see them here talking to him. And, you know, they are saying on the one hand, well, he couldn't be from God because he's breaking the Sabbath. All right, big problem for the Pharisees. But here in verse 16, in the middle of verse 16, it says, but others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? Well, that was a really important question. In fact, that was the definitive question. How can a guy who's a sinner, who's breaking the laws of God, who's not doing the right thing, and keep filling in the blank, he's just not the guy that's supposed to be, he's not supposed to be doing all these things, and yet he healed somebody. We kind of don't get that. That's the first interrogation. There's a second interrogation after they bring in his parents, and that happens in verses 24 and following. They talk to him again, okay? And I just picture this poor guy sitting there by himself in the midst of all these religious dignitaries interrogating him about what happened, okay? And at some point, they get to a discussion, and he basically says to them in verse 27, I told you already, and you wouldn't listen to me. You know, he gets a little impudent here, which is maybe part of his problem, but it's really not. It's just sort of on the surface. There's a deeper problem that's going on here, because he says, well, do you want to be his disciples too? Of course, you know, he knows they probably don't. But the fact is, he says, well, I already told you all this. And then in verses 30 through 33, I think you have, to me, one of the most powerful parts of this whole story. Because he tells them, he says, why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. You see, you know what he's telling them here? He's telling them exactly something they already knew. But quite frankly, at this point, they don't want to admit. This is a foundational document, or excuse me, a foundational doctrine of theirs. They knew God doesn't listen to sinners about this kind of stuff. They knew the stories of the prophets. They knew Moses. They knew all these other people and the miracles they had performed. They knew what kind of people they were. And he's just simply appealing to, guys, we know this. This is so logical. I can't believe you're even asking me this. You know, that's essentially, I think, what his answer is trying to tell them. I think maybe their pride was wounded. Verse 34, you were born in utter sin and you would teach us? Well, you know, they don't admit that he was right. They just say, oh, well, you can't tell us anything. More importantly, I think what we have here is we have a preconceived ideology and a certain arrogance about it prevented them from admitting the obvious. Jesus must have been a prophet. He had to be, according to their own doctrines. And they just don't want to see it. The blind man could simply say, I was blind, but now I see. You know, how could he say anything else? How could he say, no, this guy isn't from God? You know, he's really shocked. He's really shocked here. What you have here is a group of guys who've got a narrative. They've got things the way they want them to be. And something comes in there, some idea, somebody, namely Jesus, comes in with something they are not expecting. But it really does kind of fit with the overall narrative of the Bible, healing the blind. You know, sinners don't, you know, God doesn't heal people based on what sinners want him to do. They knew all this but didn't want to admit it because, well, he broke the Sabbath. their own personal ideology, the way they've set up their narrative, did not allow them to open their eyes to see who Jesus was. That's blindness. And more often than not, that's how blindness affects a lot of people. We have a preconceived idea of the way things are supposed to be. When something new comes in, on the good side, we may wrestle with it. On the bad side, we just refuse to listen to it at all. And that's what they have. So what might be the effect of all of this on us? Jesus says in verse 39, his purpose after the blind man comes back and he finally sees who Jesus is, and the desired thing that Jesus wants, he says in verse 39, for judgment I came into the world, that those who do not see may see. And there it is, folks. There is Isaiah, all the prophets, all the things that the prophets were trying to say. There is what Jesus wants for the human race. He wants people not to be blind anymore. He wants them to see the truth. He wants them to see who he is. He wants them to see the truth about who they are. He wants them and us to see the truths of his teachings. The unbelieving world is darkened in its understanding. Paul will say that in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 18. And he will say basically the same thing in Romans chapter 1 and verse 21. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. They became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. It's a horrible darkness. It doesn't seem horrible to a lot of people because they don't see it as darkness. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 through 12, Paul tells the Thessalonians that there are people in this world who simply refuse to love the truth. How do we get them to listen? Paul just says to the Ephesians, you know, you've had the eyes of your hearts open. And I think that's a very interesting expression, isn't it? The eyes of your hearts have been opened. You see. It's basically an understanding. You've accepted the truth. You understand it. You believe it. It has come to you. You have come to the realization that you are in darkness. And so that's the effect that Jesus wants to have on the human race. He wants them no longer to be blind to what's really going on in the world. And so we kind of conclude with a couple of things here. Number one, look beyond the dark lens of evil to see the light of the gospel. Those of us who are in here believe that. We have seen the light. We've seen the darkness within ourselves, but we have to keep looking beyond the dark lens of evil to see the light of the gospel. Maybe we have to kind of keep reminding ourselves of the darkness and the light, the darkness and the light. Be humble enough to see the truth about Christ. Jesus Christ is the light of the world. And I say that not just because he claims it. I think I can say that because it's really true. He is the light of the world. Be honest enough to admit that evil resides in your heart. Have faith enough to believe that Jesus is the light and can lead you out of darkness. Jesus is the light you need. Respond to him in obedience today, in faith, in being baptized for the remission of your sins. Maybe there's a few steps you need to get to before you get to the baptism and faith part, but you have to believe that he indeed is the light of the world. He can give light to you where your life is in darkness. And we want you to consider that seriously. All together we stand and sing.